Welcome to Women with Issues, where we talk about policy issues that matter to women. In this series, we're focusing on the 2020 elections and how we, as women over the age of 50, who comprise a powerful voting bloc, will use our votes to influence election outcomes this November. I'm Diane Calivris, along with my podding partner, Tracy Maxwell Hurd. Hello, Trace.
Hello, everyone. How are we?
We have a guest today, and our topic is one that is critically important to so many of our listeners, because we're talking about the 3 million grandparents in this country who are raising their grandchildren. They've taken them in, the kids are living with them, often multiple children, and not only grandparents. This includes other relatives, kinship caregivers who have taken on the responsibility of raising a family member's child. Now, the numbers are so huge, it means that over 10% of our nation's kids are in the primary care of grandparents or other relatives. So that's huge. And I think we all, even if we're not doing it ourselves, we know someone who's doing this, and I do, and the numbers are only getting bigger and bigger. So these grandparents and other kinship parents face a lot of burdens and a lot of strains, both financial and emotional, and even greater stress now with the pandemic. So there are a lot of issues to talk about. And we've got a great guest who has been involved for a long time. Barbara Turpin is a licensed social worker. She's worked at the Ohio Department of Youth Services, the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services, and Children's Defense Fund Ohio in the fields of juvenile justice, foster care, adoption, and kinship care for a combined 44 years before retiring. But you didn't stop there, did you, Barb?
No, I haven't. I've tried to stay as active as I can.
Yes, and for the past 22 years, you've continued to be an advocate for kinship care families through your work with the Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition, known as OGKC. And you currently serve also on the board of the Ohio Federation for Health Equity and Social Justice to eliminate healthcare disparities for racial and minority communities and disproportionate representation of children of color in the child welfare and juvenile justice systems. Hello, you busy, busy lady.
And in addition to that, I failed to include that is we also have 7 grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
Yes, 5 of them live here locally. So we have a very active lifestyle, keeping up with them and all their sports activities. And 2 of them live out of the city, but we try to maintain contact with them also. So we do have the grandparent experience, just not in the sense of a 24/7 kind of life with them.
Sure. And you're in Columbus, Ohio, correct?
That's correct.
Well, thank you for coming, and thank you for all the work you've done for children. I especially appreciate you because I was a foster parent, and I'm an adoptive parent of 3. So I know a little about the world of child welfare. And we need more people like you to advocate for these kids and for their caregivers.
Absolutely.
So now, since these numbers have been growing exponentially over the last few years, I know resources and legislation have just not been able to keep up. But with this pandemic, how has it impacted these families, especially since grandparents are more vulnerable to the virus?
You're right, Diane, and I want to thank you and Tracy both for reaching out to me and addressing this critical issue, especially now with some of the things that are going on with our society. So it's good to look at the issues and again, recognize the needs of these caregivers. Yes, this pandemic has really taken a toll. On a good day, when grandparents and other caregivers are generally, you know, at their limit, when they step up to take care or the responsibility of maybe one child or even multiple children that are in need of a placement, their resources are stretched thin. Either they're on a fixed income, they may be living in senior housing, they may not have additional resources, they may have been planning for a retirement. which means that now all of that is put on hold because the grandchildren have, you know, are coming first for them. So when you add in this global pandemic of illness and sometimes death, it puts a more of a strain on the limited resources that they have right now. They could be facing job insecurity. They may have had a job, but no longer can work because of the restrictions from the pandemic. There's income insecurity. Where are they going to get additional income to deal with some of the issues that come along with the pandemic? Housing might be an issue. They may not be able to pay their rent for the last few months just because of the limited income. Bills keep coming in no matter whether there's a pandemic or not. And so they have to worry about paying bills or buying food or buying, their prescriptions. Childcare is not available anymore. And if it is, it's very limited and it's expensive. And so that's an issue. If they have a job, where are the children going? Because now the children are home 24/7. There, again, it leads to food insecurity. Because the children are home 24/7, you have to plan on more meals and having more food available to them. And a lot of times they don't have the budget for that. There's lack of social activities for the kids. Libraries are closed. Rec centers are closed. I know our pools are closed here. And we're suffering through 90-degree weather for the last month. And so the restrictions on the activities force the families to be indoors more, and then that also exacerbates the possibility of exposure to the virus. Mental health issues may not be addressed because either if they were involved with possibly mental health counseling, trauma counseling, that may be put on hold. And so they're having to deal with this all in a sort of a closed environment. Lack of internet and technology access. A lot of these families are living in areas where they don't have internet access. They can't afford the internet access. They don't have access to computers because they were using the computers at school or at libraries, and now they don't have access to that. So that's even making that social circle a lot smaller. They don't have the connections that they used to have. Now we're having the issue of returning to school. What is school going to look like? Are they going to be able to return to school? Are families going to feel comfortable for the kids to return to school? If they don't, then how are they going to address their educational needs with the technology if they don't have it? And again, the isolation is really a critical part. Not being able to be part of the community and possibly maybe get support from the community when you're isolating yourselves and other people in the community are isolating themselves. So it definitely has had a very big impact on what was already a stressful situation in these caregivers' lives.
So Barb, you've listed a litany of challenges that already existed and just have been exacerbated by the current COVID situation. Can you speak a little bit to what some of the resources are, even prior to COVID, mm-hmm. that are in place that are supposed to help kinship care providers manage this or, you know, incorporate this into their lives better?
Right. There are some resources available. It's not an exorbitant amount of financial assistance for caregivers. Right now, for caregivers, most caregivers will be able to access federal monies that are sent for medical coverage for the children because it's just based on the child and the child's needs and child's eligibility. So probably 100% of kids are eligible for medical coverage through the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. The other financial support is through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the TANF Cash mm-hmm. Assistance Program. And that is separate from any grandparents' income. It's based on the child's needs only. And like I said, probably 99-100% of all children will be receiving the cash assistance benefit through whatever agency handles that in the state. They could also be eligible for the entire family if they meet the eligibility requirements. So the entire family could also be eligible for the cash assistance if they are, you know, in need and meet the income requirements. other programs that are available to families but are based on the income of the caregiver would be SSI for the child and for the caregiver. Food stamps, unfortunately, are connected to the income of the caregiver, which sometimes eliminates the ability for them to get food stamps. Free and reduced school lunches are, again, they're based on income of the caregiver, and child care. So these are also supportive programs, but they're not available to all the families based on the eligibility criteria.
Got it. So Diane, jump in here. You, having done the foster care side of this, what are some of the differences in terms of what the benefits are that are provided for a foster care parent versus kinship care families? Because it seemed like in some of the data that you sent us ahead of time that it wasn't equal.
Well, that when I was on the board of OFCA, the Ohio Family Care Association, that was just one of the issues that was, you know, that we were trying to address, that kinship caregivers were not eligible for the same resources that foster parents were. I don't know what the room and board subsidy is now, but when I was fostering, which was probably 15 years ago, was when I last fostered, it was about $550 a month per child. And I can't remember if that was I had a couple of kids that were eligible for Title IV-E, which means they had special needs. Mine had special needs. They were on medications. But I just know kinship families, you know, did not receive the same kinds of supports. Also, you know, we were eligible for respite care, which meant that we could get breaks, mm-hmm. you know, and those were it was paid for. You know, even after I adopted my three boys, we were eligible for paid respite.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And
I think that, you know, the assumption is that if it's your family member, if it's your niece, nephew, if it's your grandchild, that you shouldn't need respite, or that you, this is your family and you're obligated to provide, you know, whatever is needed, either financially and emotionally. But come on, you know, you're talking about people who have raised their children and are trying to save for retirement. And a lot of those, you know, those retirement dreams have dissolved now. So Barb, you know, what, am I right about these?
Yeah, you're right on target, Diane. You're right about the inequities between foster caregivers and kinship caregivers. And I think that has come through a process historically of families always stepping up and feeling they have a responsibility to make sure that those children are not put in a system. Mm-hmm. And they will do whatever they have to do up front and then worry about the consequences later, about the struggles and about the issues that come later. But they don't want that child to go into a system, mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, because a lot of times that, you know, involvement in the system ends up causing additional issues, traumatic issues and other things. So historically, families have stepped up to do this without regard to the kind of strain and stress it's going to put on that situation. And in foster care, it's a definitely needed service. There are times where families aren't available. There's a federal mandate to all states that because of the Title IV-E program and requirements, in order for states to get that reimbursement for foster care and adoption payments, states are required to diligently search for a relative or a family friend first when they take custody of a child. And that search has to be a diligent search. It just can't be a phone call to, you know, one member of the family and then that's it. They do have to do a diligent search to look for a relative caregiver or a friend of the family who's willing to take that child, and they can be approved. And because of that, then that first layer has to be addressed. And generally, that's when relatives will come forward and say, yes, I don't want my relative child to go into foster care. I will take this child and then look for resources later. And a lot of times, agencies don't tell the families up front about what resources are available or how minimal the resources are going to be. So mm-hmm. they get into the situation and then they find out that, you know, they're going to get a few hundred dollars a month, as opposed to what Diane, you were talking about. Foster care rates are all over the place. You mentioned special needs. You can get a base per diem rate of, let's say, $100 a day for a child. And then because of the special needs, there can be a couple of more $100 added on to that per day. So technically, foster families can get possibly thousands of dollars a month. This is a month to right. care for that same child that is going into a relative or a friend's home. And then you talk about the additional services. Yes, there's counseling, there's respite, there's other educational supports. So there are other supported services that go along with that foster care placement that aren't necessarily easily available to the caregivers. So there is desperate treatment between foster families and caregivers. And over time, that's become more of an issue when caregivers find that there is a sort of a double standard in the system for children that have to be placed in outside their home.
Barb, I know that the Ohio legislature did some work, and I want to say it was back during my freshman term. Representative Barbara Boyd was the one, I believe, who actually sponsored that out of Cleveland, because she had a lot of experience just in healthcare industry and specifically with kinship care. What did we get right and what did we not, and what was left void in that?
Well, Representative Boyd is certainly a champion. We've honored her at our Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition seminars that we've had in the past. She was one of the first people to recognize that kinship caregivers need support mm-hmm. outside of what's available to them. She passed the legislation that provided funding and implementation of a kinship navigator, statewide kinship navigator program back mm-hmm. in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. That was a program that I was involved in when I was working at the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. I had the distinct honor of coordinating that program statewide and seeing how it was able to make an impact on caregivers. With $3 million a year, we were able to get kinship navigators into 77 counties, and those navigators were able to connect families with resources that they may not have known about, that the Children's Services Agency may not have known about. And then you have the informal caregivers where the children don't come through agency custody, who are just on their own out there trying to find the resources. And these navigators played a significant role in making sure they were connected with the resources that were available to them. That went for a 2-year budget period, and then after that, that money was reallocated and redistributed. So after that 2-year budget period, that program was maintained in a lot of the counties that kept it with local support, local financial support. And even today, almost 25 years later, there are about 5 counties that have maintained that kinship navigator position in their counties to continue to help their kinship caregivers. And then subsequent to that, you know, Representative Boyd retired several years ago, mm-hmm. and her daughter has taken up her charge, Janine Boyd, mm-hmm. and she's followed in her mom's footsteps, and we are so glad because we love working with Representative Janine Boyd, mm-hmm. and she has then taken it up and reintroduced legislation that was passed in the last budget cycle to implement another statewide kinship navigator program. And there's been significant money put into developing and implementing this. We're anticipating it to be up and running in some of the counties here in early fall, around August or September. They're in the planning stages, the evaluation stages, and so we hope to have some navigators in counties and in early fall again, which should be a significant help to caregivers.
Wow, that's great.
Awesome.
How does Ohio do comparatively with other states? Does kinship caregiving rely on state funds for the most part? And as far as the navigators, is that being modeled on another state?
Actually, Ohio is the model for kinship navigator programs statewide. That first navigator program that we implemented through Representative Boyd's initiative has been a model for other states when they decided to do the Navigator program. And actually, Representative Clinton and Representative Snow came to Ohio back in the early 90s to look at what was going on in Ohio with the Kinship Navigator program. And they included that in the legislation they passed around family supports back when, you know, they were together in the legislature. So Ohio is the model. We've struggled over the years to maintain that support through financial support in legislation and expanding that support. But we've continued to try to be at the forefront of the supports to kinship caregivers and to the states around the country. So we're right up there with most states. Some states are doing a little bit better in terms of support. We have the federal financial support. The state can legislate financial support through the budgets that are passed. And then local agencies, we have a state-supervised, county-administered system here in Ohio, and I think there may be only 7 or 8 other states that operate that way. Most of the states have a state-administered system, but Ohio hasn't, and so we have 88 different county child welfare agencies that do things a little bit different depending on what their needs are. And a lot of the counties have allocated their local funds to give support to caregivers. They may do, you know, additional financial support. They may pay for child care. They may pay for recreational activities, respite care. So local counties have the ability to craft and implement programs locally at the local level with their own funds to help help kinship caregivers out. And there are quite a few of them that do that.
Stick with us, ladies, while we take a very short break.
Barb, why, and maybe this is happening and I'm just simply not aware of it, but why are we not just advocating for equipoise across the board? You know, that whatever is allocated for foster care would also be the same resources allocated for kinship care, and just have a package of resources that are attached to the child, regardless of, you know, and there could be an opportunity to opt out if the family happened to be, you know, of significant means and didn't feel that they needed it, but that there would always be some fundamental minimal threshold of resources that would be available and provided for the child, regardless of who the caregiver was.
Well, OGKC has been pushing for that, and that's an excellent question and an excellent issue, because if you look at the money that, I mean, if you want to get to a bottom line where a lot of the agencies do at the fiscal level, they look at the fiscal impact of situations. Caregivers save the state and the counties a tremendous amount of money. Administrative money in taking care of those children, that you don't have the caseworkers coming out to the homes, you don't have to open a case, you don't have to monitor a case. There's administrative involved, direct service money involved, you know, all of those supports that agencies provide and pay for are not necessarily being paid for to the caregiver. So they're saving a lot of money. The foster care payment is not being made. So there's a lot of advantages to having children placed in kinship care, because if all of those kids would suddenly come into the child welfare system, it wouldn't be able to hold them. It would go broke. And we don't know what would happen. So that package of services that could be crafted for caregivers is definitely something that OGK is advocating for. We're working with our U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, as well as our Representative Joyce Beatty, to look at making those services and financial supports like child care, food stamps, the free and reduced lunches, all of those that are tied to the eligibility of the grandparents' income, take that away, just like they do for TANF and the Medicaid. Take all of that, those requirements away, link it to the child only, and make a package available to families that come for the child, not based on the circumstances of the caregiver. So we are advocating for that. We're pushing for it. Senator Brown has just been wonderful in terms of his support for caregivers. He's introduced legislation to support the Family Transformation Act, provide money for states to be able to do those kinds of activities. And we've reached out to him to talk to him about this supportive package of services to caregivers.
So this package, would it be, are we talking just for Ohio, or is this a nationwide?
No, it would be federal. I mean, it would be the federal requirements for these programs. Once that money gets to the state, the programs or the eligibility requirements that come along with that to the states would then be changed to just meet the needs of the child, where the caregiver's income and circumstances weren't considered. So it would have to be federally, the legislation would have to change at the federal level in order for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. What can we do to help get that passed? What can voters do?
You can contact your U.S. senator and, representatives in Congress. Let them know that you would like to see them support anything that Senator Sherrod Brown is proposing in terms of providing support to caregivers. Encourage them to introduce legislation that would allow for the eligibility criteria to be tied to the child only. Because we have examples of how that works. We have the TANF cash assistance and the Medicaid are both tied to the child only. So it should be tied to that child's circumstances. So you can, advocate, talk to your representatives at the congressional level about changing legislation that would allow that to happen.
And I wanted to mention too something I was thinking about. I guess one of the big advantages that maybe people don't think about is that outcomes are probably better when children are placed with, family caregivers, people that they know. People that they're comfortable with. It's their family. So in the long run, investing more money in supporting family caregivers would save money in the long run.
Exactly. There have been studies that show that the outcomes are better for children who are placed in a relative or a close friend's care as opposed to foster care.
Sure, and that only makes sense, right?
Right. If you think about yourself, who would you rather be with if for some reason, at any point in time, you had to leave your parents? Mm-hmm. And who would you rather be with? Somebody that you know, somebody you feel comfortable with, that you've had a relationship over a period of time, or somebody who is a total stranger to you.
A stranger, right.
That you've never known, you've never seen them, you don't know what their lifestyle is, you don't know what's going to be expected of you. And so there's a study that came out, Pew Charitable Trust and the Generations United issued a report in 2018 that shows that research indicates that children do better in families where they have the connections. They have the connections to the family. They have connections to their community, their schools. A lot of times they don't have to change schools. Mm-hmm. Their friends, they still can maintain their friendships. And there's less trauma, there's less stress in that move. There's still going to be some, but it's not increased because now they're going to a stranger. And all of that then is in addition to the trauma of what was going on in the home, whatever was going on with the family that caused them to have to be removed. That placement in a stranger home just heightens that whole trauma issue where it's not necessary if you can find a relative or a friend to take that child. So there is research that shows that they are safer and less traumatized if they can be placed with a kinship caregiver.
Well, sometimes we spend money to do research to learn things that should be just common sense like that, right?
Definitely. It amazes me at sometimes some of the money that's spent on research that, like you said, is common sense issues and common sense knowledge. But sometimes you just need that to prove to the legislators and to the administrators that this is the best thing to do and we need support for it.
So it's showing there's been research in terms of outcomes, in terms of the child transitioning better into family situations versus into foster care. But is there a financial formulation for this? For example, are they doing the research that shows that we're spending more money further down the line in these children who are having other issues. For example, with the criminal justice system, you know, we are always equate what we spend in early childhood development and, you know, the public school system, those dollars and the dollars that we're not spending, if we were investing better in those areas, specifically in early childhood, that would eliminate and reduce significantly the number of children who engage the criminal justice system. So are you doing that kind of math there? Because I found in the legislature, you know, money talks. If you can show that, you know, this is maybe even if it's long-term, that there still is a cost savings for, you know, giving more investment into kinship care, you know, that might be a way to go as well. Is that part of that that data?
I'm sure it is. That report is fairly long, but again, sort of a common sense kind of a conclusion that if you put those resources up front and don't increase the amount of trauma, the amount of social distancing, the amount of stress that a child goes through, if you don't add to what already exists, then in the long run, you're going to have a healthier child mentally and physically, and even as they go into adulthood. If you hear stories of children who have grown up in foster care as opposed to children that grew up in kinship care with grandparents or other relatives or friends, there's definitely a difference in the outcomes for those children. Definitely there is a significant pay back for putting a child into a relative's home as opposed to that child in foster care. And a lot of it would have to do with the length of time they had to be there. You know, hopefully in foster care, the child is there until the family can get their issues together and move back into the home. Sometimes relative placements last a little longer, but it gives that family a little bit more time to get things together and be more stable. Foster care, sometimes the child may be placed back home and issues that come up again and the child has to be removed and replaced. So there again is another traumatic issue. So it's just more stable. The stability in a relative home, a kinship home, is significantly better than that instability in a foster care home.
You know, I think that's more of a universal conversation too, because it's not just about providing supports to sustain and create an environment for the child, but addressing whatever the situation was that caused the child to be removed from the home in the first place. So kinship care, I think, is wonderful, and I think it's probably the ideal solution when there is a loving, supportive family member, you know, willing to do that. Because a child can feel just as unsafe in a family member's home as they could in a stranger's home. So that's not an absolute given. You know, I think probably, right. You know, statistically, that is the better option for the child. I wouldn't dispute that. But I think there can be challenges there as well.
Right.
And that's what the Family First Transition and Support Act legislation 2019, that's one of the goals of that legislation, is to put in place resources and try to revamp the child welfare system and some of these other systems to put in place where they are supporting that biological family. Mm-hmm. They're not just, you know, looking at disrupting that family and taking the children away and then sort of leaving the parents hanging, but looking at keeping that child in the home with adequate supports to keep, you know, the parents and the children together, with counseling, with drug and alcohol, addiction services, with whatever services are needed to keep that family together. And hopefully with those services, that would work out. Now, in some cases, it's not, and there's too much of a safety issue. But I think there's been a lot of cases that maybe agencies were too quick to remove the children before they gave the parents an opportunity to do what they needed to do and work with those parents. So the transition, Family First Transition Support Act was passed to support this. And then subsequently, Senator Brown and Senator Debbie Sabineau from Michigan have put together this legislation. And as far as I know today, it hasn't been passed, but it is there to help the Family First Transition Support Act to give states the resources to implement this Support Act of 2019. So again, Senator Brown is really at the forefront of supporting families and right. getting these services and supports in place to not only serve the caregivers if they do take the children, but even before that, let's service the parents first and mm-hmm. see what we can accomplish there before that decision is made to completely remove the child and either put them in a caregiver home or a foster placement.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at that Family First Transition and Support Act now, and it says that the states can use federal dollars for things like drug abuse treatment for the parents to prevent. These are preventative measures to prevent the kids from going into the system to begin with. I just want to talk too a little bit about the different types of custody that grandparents or kinship caregivers can get. They're not all the same, are they, Barb?
No, they're not. And interestingly enough, we've had a virtual support group that has been started here in the Central Ohio area it's gone statewide because now it's online. But they meet twice a week. It's through a grant that was offered to a graduate student at OSU. And she's developed topic matters for caregivers. And one of the topic matters that was discussed last week that caregivers really wanted to know more about were the legal issues and the custody issues that people and caregivers run up against or just don't know. And so we had some Bar Association attorneys present around the legal issues that caregivers face. And there are a couple of legal statuses that caregivers can have with the children in their care. One of them is just none. I mean, it's an informal placement. Whatever happened in the family, the parents have decided that they're not able to take care of the children, and they place with a relative. And it's done informally. Nobody may know about it. Children's Services doesn't have to know about it. And life goes on. Now, the caregiver may have some issues in getting the children in school or getting them on the medical coverage, that kind of thing. But that is a status that they can have. From that point, they could go to court themselves and petition the court for legal custody, which means that if they were granted legal custody, that caregiver would have legal rights to access medical care of the child, enroll them in school, anything that a parent basically would do that a caregiver has the ability to do. It doesn't terminate the parental rights. The parents still have parental rights to the child. But in order for that legal custody to be terminated, it has to go back through the court system. The judge has to agree that, and it's not the parent's situation that's changed. It has to rule that the change in the caregiver situation is such that the child can be, that custody can be terminated and the child can go back to the parent. So it's a court-involved situation, and when the court gives the legal custody, they're pretty much saying that you're opting in for a long-term relationship with this child, legal relationship with the child. Then there's the situation where the child is removed from the home through Children's Services. Children's Services takes custody, places with the caregiver, and ultimately the caregiver has temporary custody through Children's Services. But ultimately, either the child will go back to the parent if the parent's working on a case plan, and the Children's Services stays involved with that parent, or if that doesn't happen, if that can't come to fruition, then that caregiver would then. They would go through court and again obtain legal custody, the same as with a non-child welfare placed child. So legal custody is one of the ways that caregivers get legal responsibility. There are two other options that we have in Ohio. We passed a number of years ago two pieces of legal status for caregivers. But it's only for grandparents. It's the grandparent power of attorney, and it's a grandparent caregiver authorization. The power of attorney is an agreement between the parent and the caregiver, that the parent is giving over the legal responsibility to the caregiver without going through legal custody through the court, and is agreeing that the caregiver can take care of the child. And this agreement is in place for about a year. It also has to be filed in court. It has to be filed in the juvenile court system. So, the court has it on record. And then after a year's time, even before that, the caregiver can revoke that at any point in time and take back the responsibility for the child. The other one is a caregiver authorization affidavit, and that's when a grandparent does not know where the parents are, and they testify and file it in court that they don't know, and they need this authorization to be able to get services for the child. But they are only limited to grandparents, and we are looking at right now trying to advocate for expanding that to other caregivers, because you have aunts, uncles, cousins, even brothers and sisters who take on that responsibility, but then they don't have the legal authority.
Even close family friends or church members that know the child.
Exactly.
I bring this up because I'm sure this isn't the only situation, but we are sort of semi-involved now, my husband and I, with a 14-year-old boy who we became aware of, that he had been couch surfing basically for almost a couple of years. So just kind of, he was one of 10 children, single mom with 10 children. And we found out that he was staying on a friend's couch for several months. And before that, on another friend of hers, a couch. He had met these women through his church. And mom really didn't seem to be bothered by the fact that he was not at home and wasn't really in contact with these caregivers. Luckily, they were good people, nice people. And he did not want to go home because the home situation was, there were brothers and sisters doing drugs. Some other friends who were actually trying to get their foster care license ended up taking him in, and they had him in school, but they were not even able to attend parent-teacher conferences. They weren't able to get access to his IEP to find out what he needed help with. Mm. So they really had to fight. They had to go to court and finally were able to convince the mother to give them power of attorney, which was the bare minimum that they could get in terms of, you know, custody, if you want to call that. Then he's still there and he's doing well, but it just goes to show that there's so many different levels, caregiving, with the legal custody, the power of attorney, custody of the state with temporary custody to a relative. And all of those have different resources attached to them and different
worries,
different rights, and different worries and different financial resources. So, Barb, I wonder if you can help our listeners that, you know, are in situations where they are family caregivers, grandparent caregivers. What are the resources available? Where can they go?
Right. In their states, they should be able to, if they aren't involved with any of the local systems agencies and they get a child placed with them, either informal or formal, they want to contact their local state departments that do the Medicaid, the cash assistance, and then the child welfare agencies, because a lot of times child welfare agencies, even though the child didn't come through them, that they may have programs. Here in Ohio, we have the Kinship Permanency Incentive Program, and that's for families who have taking custody of a child. It doesn't have to be through the child welfare agency, but if they have custody of that child, they can get some financial support through their children's services agencies. So they want to contact those agencies to find out, ask the questions about what's available for kinship caregivers. I'm a grandparent. I need help. I have my grandchild. What do I need to do to get services and financial support? So it's important for them to connect with those agencies. A lot of times, caregivers, grandparents know nothing about welfare, have never had to go to a child welfare agency, have never had to go to a Medicaid or cash assistance to get public assistance, food stamps. They don't know anything about that. In Ohio, we're working on the Navigator program. In other states, there may be a Navigator program. So I recommend just Googling kinship care in their state and see what pops up. Generations United, GU, which you can just Google GU, has a ton of resources out there for individual states. They have state profiles, state resource information, and that's a good place to start to look at agencies that may be in your state that support kinship caregivers or who to contact for support. So GU, Generations United, is a good place to start because they have all kinds of information. And Ohio has OGKC. If they Google OGKC, a lot of the national resources are on OGKC also. And so there's, you know, Generations United link is there. Other national resources are out there, as well as our state and local resources. And try to connect with support groups. I know it's hard now, but if you can go online and find a support group in your local city or state, connect with that support group, because you'd be amazed at what kind of information other grandparents have that have gone through the system, or other caregivers that are already gone through the system and can provide you with the context that you need to get help with your situation. So connecting with other caregivers is also an important resource.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Barb. You have given us a wealth of information to think about, to digest, to, of course, share with our listeners here. An important and really timely topic as we're in the midst of, you know, COVID. We've not yet come out of that. You know, we're supposedly getting ready to go into another recession. Mm-hmm. So all of those things really just going to exacerbate parents being in stressful situations, you know, and maybe needing a little kinship help, and really looking at how we can better support our families through this pandemic and just through the kinship care process universally long-term.
We should put list some of these resources on our Facebook page for our listeners.
Absolutely. And also list the legislation that Senator Sherrod Brown is working on so that people can reference that when they call their various congresspeople, you know, senators and U.S. representatives to support this, because, you know, this is a national podcast. So we certainly want people to call in from all over the country because that's how it goes. Senator Sherrod Brown won't be able to pass that without support from members from all over the country. So yeah, we'll get that posted as well on our website.
That's wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us, Barb. I think a lot of people are going to find that really, really helpful.
For sure.
And thank you for listening. Make sure you find us on Facebook, facebook.com/womenwithissuespodcast. And also we are on Instagram and Twitter. And I want to put a shout out again to our technical producer, Cade Hessman.
Yay, Cade.
Yay, Cade. He does all the stuff for us that Tracy and I are not tech savvy enough to do.
Right.
We'll talk to everyone next time. Thank you.
We are Women with Issues.
And we're talking to you.
Thanks so much.